You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line, supporters are outraged at U.S. prosecutors over a new indictment of Palestinian political prisoner Dr. Sami Alarian after he refused to appear before a grand jury probing an Islamic charity in Northern Virginia. We'll get an update from Dr. Alarian's daughter, Layla, regarding this latest indictment. Also this week, after enduring 4 months in captivity in Iraq at the hands of Islamic extremists, a Canadian human rights worker is detained for 4 days, refused access to a lawyer, physically assaulted, and denied entry into Israel. We'll speak with nonviolent activist Harmeet Sudan about his ordeal. And finally, Crossing the Line presents an audio documentary feature on the architecture of the occupation, Then and Now, produced by David Parker of CKDU 88.1 in Halifax, Nova Scotia. All of that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
This week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for June 28th through July 4th, 2008. As Hamas calls for the permanent opening of the Rafah crossing, two Palestinian patients died in Gaza due to the Israeli siege. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. We begin our weekly report with recent nonviolent actions in the West Bank. IMEMC's Sam Orwell has the details.
Three activists were injured by Israeli forces on Friday in the weekly protest against the separation wall in Bilayn, near the West Bank city of Ramallah. Two of them are French activists, and the third one is Mohammed Ali Abu Saadi, 65 years old. Additionally, dozens of protesters were treated for tear gas inhalation. Villagers from Bilayn marched together with international and Israeli solidarity activists after Friday prayers, carrying Palestinian flags and banners demanding the removal of the Israeli wall and settlements. As protesters approached the separation wall, Israeli forces prevented the villagers from reaching the gate that is supposed to provide access to their lands and opened fire on them with tear gas canisters, sound bombs, and rubber-coated metal bullets. Three were injured and scores of protesters were treated for gas inhalation. The Israeli army attacked a peaceful protest organized by the villagers of Salamuna, located near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem on Friday morning. Three protesters were kidnapped by the army. Local sources said that scores of villagers, supported by Israeli and international peace activists, marched from the main entrance of the village towards the lands that are in danger of being confiscated due to the building of the wall. The participants held Palestinian flags and banners condemning the Israeli action of building the wall and also calling for unity among Palestinians. Soldiers attacked the protesters and kidnapped three activists, one Israeli and two Palestinian. When other protesters tried to stop the jeep from taking them away, troops forced the activists, using rifle butts and batons, out of the way. Later in the day, and also near Bethlehem, the village of El-Khadr organized on Friday midday a nonviolent protest against the illegal Israeli wall being built on the village's land. At least 150 Palestinians from the village of El-Khadr, along with international supporters, staged the protest at the nearby Settlers' Road. The march started with midday prayers held near the army checkpoint there, and then speeches were delivered by local organizers. Israeli soldiers arrived at the protest and announced that the area was a closed military zone and asked the protesters to move away. Protesters stood their ground and staged a protest for another hour or so. In his speech, Samir Jaber, an organizer in El-Khadr, said that, "On this special day for Americans who are celebrating their independence, Palestine is also calling for that right." For IMEMC.org, this is Sam Orwell.
Palestinian Prime Minister of the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, Ismail Haniyeh, emphasized on Thursday the need for the Rafah crossing terminal to be reopened in agreement with all parties concerned. IMEMC's Jane Smith has the details.
Haniyeh's statement came after riots ripped through the terminal on Wednesday as thousands of stranded Palestinian travelers and patients attempted to cross to the Egyptian side of the terminal. prompting Egyptian authorities to close the crossing. Egypt's foreign minister Ahmed Abu Ghayat described the Wednesday incidents as a silly attempt to breach the border lines, while warning of grave consequences and asserting that Egypt always tries to ease the travel of Palestinians in and out of the besieged Gaza Strip. The Hamas-dominated government denied that the event was planned and blamed Israel's procrastination in reopening the border crossings for the eruption of the events in a time in which Gaza's 1.5 million residents have been trapped between the closed border crossings since June 2007. Hamas and Israel agreed 2 weeks ago to an Egyptian-mediated truce deal, which would see the gradual reopening of Gaza's crossings in return for the halting of the firing of Palestinian homemade shells. As for the Rafah crossing terminal, which Egypt controls, Cairo wants the crossing to be reopened in accordance with the 2005 U.S. brokered agreement and in coordination with the Palestinian presidency, which has not held sway in Gaza for more than a year now. On a related issue, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert confirmed this week that talks over the release of captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit would continue, expecting what he termed painful decisions for the deal to be concluded. Israel and the Hamas party have been negotiating a possible prisoner swap deal through Egyptian mediators. The deal would see the release of a few hundred Palestinian prisoners in exchange for Shalit, yet Israel insists that it will not release some of the names on Hamas's list. In the meantime, Israel media reports said this week that Israel and the Lebanese Hezbollah party are about to conclude a prisoner swap deal in which Israel would release hundreds of Lebanese, Palestinian, and Arab prisoners in exchange for the corpses of Israeli soldiers and information on other missing Israeli soldiers. On the Palestinian-Israeli negotiation level, Washington and some other member states of the United Nations Security Council expressed concern over a new draft resolution presented by Libya on behalf of the Arab states that demands halt of Israeli settlement activities on occupied Palestinian territory. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was quoted as saying that the Security Council should not intervene in Palestinian-Israeli issues, as both Palestinians and Israelis continue to hold negotiations. On the internal Palestinian level, the major rival parties, Fatah of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas of Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniya, traded accusations this week over the blocking of a genuine national dialogue. On Thursday, Fatah official in the West Bank, Ahmed Abdul Rahman, blamed Haniya's visit to an abandoned Palestinian presidential headquarters in Gaza as an indication to Hamas's domination of Gaza. Meanwhile, Sami Abu Zahri, Hamas's spokesman in Gaza, criticized recent remarks by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to foreign media outlets that Hamas should adhere to international demands. Asked by IMEMC's correspondent about current Palestinian efforts to bridge the gap between Fatah and Hamas for the benefit of Palestinian unity, Rabah Mahna, a Gaza-based leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, maintained,
"In this respect, we have opened the profile of political detainees of both sides in Gaza and Ramallah, with the aim of widening the prisons there of such detainees as a preliminary step towards dialogue. Then we have proposed forming a preparatory committee for organizing a comprehensive national dialogue, and we are working relentlessly with all forces concerned."
In June 2007, Hamas-led forces ousted Fatah-loyal security personnel and leaders from the Gaza Strip amidst factional fighting within the Fatah party. Afterwards, Abbas outlawed Hamas and demanded an end to what he called coup against legitimacy before any dialogue is initiated with this party. Last month, Abbas launched an initiative for dialogue based on a Yemeni proposal for conciliation. The ruling Hamas party in Gaza has been sidelined by America, Israeli, and Western governments since the party took power in 2006 parliamentary elections. International players demand Hamas to recognize Israel, drop its resistance agenda, and adhere to previously signed peace agreements with Israel. For IMEMC.org, this is Jane Smith.
Two Palestinian patients died this week due to the continued siege of the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Israeli troops beat up an award-winning Gazan journalist on the borders. This and more by IMEMC's Rami Al-Magheri in Gaza.
Spokesman of the Popular Committee Against the Israeli Blockade, Rami Abdo, announced on Wednesday that patient number 200, died after having been unable to go for treatment outside of Gaza, as Israel continues to close border crossings that have been shut for more than 1 year now. Mazen Arar, 20, a cardiac patient, died while he was waiting to enter through the Rafah crossing terminal on Tuesday, but could not do so due to the continued closure of Gaza, which Israel enforced in June 2007. Arar's death is the second in 24 hours, as well as the 8-month-old infant Ayad Anwar Dhaik of the Nusayrat refugee camp after she was unable to go outside of Gaza on Tuesday. A Palestinian woman was shot and injured by Israeli army fire near the Safa crossing in the southern part of the Gaza Strip on Tuesday morning. Medical sources report that 35-year-old Aisha Atiya sustained moderate wounds in her leg and was moved to a nearby hospital for treatment. Witnesses reported that the Israeli soldiers manning the borders opened fire without any reason, injuring Aisha. On Monday night, Israel informed the Egyptian mediators of the truce between Hamas, which controls Gaza, and Israel, that the Israeli troops will open fire at any Palestinian that approaches too close to the borders. The Hamas movement considers this Israeli decision a violation of the truce mediated by Egypt between Hamas and Israel 3 weeks ago. The Egyptian authorities closed on Wednesday afternoon the Rafah crossing terminal after hundreds of Palestinians, mainly patients and stranded people, flooded into the Egyptian side of the terminal as their entry has been delayed. The angry awaiting travelers began heading for the terminal on Wednesday midday after they had been waiting since the early morning as their entry had been delayed by the Egyptian authorities, witnesses said. Egypt decided Tuesday to reopen the Rafah crossing terminal to allow some dozens of patients who are in need of medical care and hundreds of stranded Palestinians at both sides of the border to enter. The Rafah crossing terminal has been closed since June 2007. Also this week, Palestinian journalist Mohammed Omar from Rafah was harassed by Israeli border authorities on his way back from a speaking tour in Europe. Upon arrival to Jordan, he was informed by the Dutch embassy that he is not welcomed in Israel. However, the Dutch embassy coordinated his entry with the Israeli authorities and thus he proceeded to King Hussein Terminal on Thursday. Israeli border police stopped him and detained him for an interrogation. Omar told IMEMC over the phone that he was beaten by the Israeli intelligence officers. Omar won Martha Gilhern Journalism Prize 2008 for articles he published in the Washington Report magazine describing the hard living conditions the Palestinian people are facing due to the ongoing siege on the Gaza Strip. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli army conducted at least 44 military invasions targeting Palestinian communities in the West Bank. During these attacks, Israeli troops killed one child and kidnapped 42 Palestinian civilians, including two children. IMEMC's Jay Sheridan with the story.
This week's kidnappings were focused in the cities of Jenin, Hebron, and Nablus, where 24 civilians were kidnapped on Thursday. With this week's kidnappings, the number of Palestinian civilians kidnapped by the Israeli army from the West Bank since the beginning of 2008 has mounted to 1,424. Palestinian medical sources in the West Bank city of Tubas reported that Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Sunday at dawn a 17-year-old youth from the city. The sources identified the youth as Mohammed Nasser Dragma. He was standing near the main road of the city when the soldiers opened fire on him. On Thursday evening, at least six Palestinian youth were wounded by Israeli military fire after the army invaded Al-Farar refugee camp near the northern West Bank city of Nablus and clashed with the local youth, who hurled stones at the invading forces. On Thursday midday, the Israeli army demolished two Palestinian-owned homes in the city of Jerusalem. The Israeli army also attacked the families who tried to stop the bulldozers and injured some of them. The Israeli army says the homes were built without needed permits. Since it occupied the city, Israel has rarely given building permits to the Palestinians of Jerusalem. Moreover, an Israeli police force and army unit attacked on Thursday morning the homes of Palestinian families that live in Jerusalem's Old City. Witnesses said that soldiers fired tear gas and sound bombs at residents' homes that searched a number of them. During the search, witnesses added that police officers detained men and beat them up. Eid Kwas, an owner of one of those homes, was beaten up so badly that he had to be sent to the hospital. Palestinian sources said that Israeli settlers fired on Tuesday homemade shells at the village of Buran, located near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Local sources said that two shells landed on open areas near a local farmhouse, causing no injuries or damage. Khair Abu Amran from the local civil defense department in the village told IMEMC that the settlers fired the homemade shells from the nearby settlement of Bakra, which is built on the village land. He added that Israeli troops invaded the village and took the remains of the shells that were collected by the villagers. The Israeli army injured a Palestinian resistance leader during an army attack on the northern West Bank city of Jenin on Tuesday at dawn. Ala Abu al-Rab, the leader of the Al-Quds brigades in Jenin, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad, sustained moderate wounds in the attack. Local sources stated that an undercover Israeli army unit ambushed Abu al-Rab in Qabatiya, a town near Jenin. Troops opened fire at Abu al-Rab and injured him, but he managed to flee the scene of the attack. Abu al-Rab was targeted by the Israeli army several times over the past year, the Islamic Jihad reported. At least three Israelis have been killed and 30 were wounded too seriously as a bulldozer attacked a bus and a number of cars on Jaffa Street in West Jerusalem on Wednesday midday. Israeli sources said a Palestinian from Jerusalem, identified as Tazer Dawakat, age 31, carried out this attack and was shot by Israeli police who were in the area. The attacker, according to an Israeli police source, had a criminal record. No Palestinian groups claim responsibility for the attack. For IMEMC.org, this is Jay Sheridan.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. This week's report was brought to you by Ghassan Benoura and Nathan Dennison.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. Supporters of jailed Palestinian professor Sami Alarian are voicing outrage over another new indictment against him in a case unrelated to his original jailing. On Thursday, June 26th, prosecutors indicted Alarian for refusing to appear before a grand jury probing an Islamic charity in Northern Virginia. Alarian has already spent an additional 18 months in prison for refusing to testify. He was due to be released in April after serving 5 years on charges that he was a leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. He had accepted that sentence after reaching a plea agreement to avoid a second trial. In his original trial, a Florida jury failed to return a single guilty verdict on any of the 17 charges brought against him. With us on the phone to talk about this new indictment is Dr. Alarian's daughter, Layla Alarian, a freelance journalist who contributes frequently to The Nation magazine and is a correspondent for Al Jazeera English, and is the co-author of the book Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Layla Alarian, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
Layla, the Justice Department has issued a new indictment charges against your father. Can you talk about these charges? What exactly happened?
Well, for the past, I guess I'd say, 2 months, really, since April, when my father was supposed to have been released, we feared something like this might happen. My father was supposed to have been released April 8th, but the day of his release, they transferred him from the Marshals Service custody to the immigration authorities, and we feel that this was probably just a formality, that they had planned to charge him all along and that they were just buying time. So what happened was, for the past, I'd say, year and a half, a prosecutor in Virginia named Gordon Kronberg has been trying to force my father to testify in a completely separate case other than his. His case had already been completed. He signed the plea agreement with the government. This whole nightmare was supposed to be over. But when my father refused to testify for various reasons, including the fact that it was a violation of his plea agreement to force him to testify, and also because he had nothing to contribute to this investigation, and finally because it was against his conscience to engage in these types of cases and to put innocent people through what he's been through already. So He was placed in civil contempt for 18 months, which means that his sentence on his original case was frozen. And civil contempt was supposed to be a way to try to force him to testify. Of course, that didn't work. And in the course of him serving civil contempt, he went on two different hunger strikes, in which he lost 50 pounds each time, and he became extremely thin and frail. And this was really an extremely strong statement on his behalf, which is on his part, which is that he was not going to testify, and that he was even willing to risk his own health to prove that point. Even so, he is now being charged with two counts of criminal contempt for not testifying, and his trial has already been scheduled for August 13th. And next week, we're actually having a hearing to argue that he should be released on bond pending trial. So we're preparing for that as well. So I guess what I would say is 2.5 years after being found not guilty by a federal jury, we never would have expected we'd be in this situation where he's facing yet another trial. It's obviously very distressing to my whole family.
Layla, you mentioned that Gordon Kromberg, who we've talked about before on the show when we've had you in the past, as well as your mother, it almost seems that he's determined in order to indict your father on something, in order to put your father in prison. Is this basically based on the fact that your father was acquitted of all charges in his original trial, or what
yeah,
is
I
the
mean,
man?
I think it, unfortunately, I think it even goes beyond Gordon Kromberg. I mean, I think he's sort of the name and the face we know in this case, but I think it does go to the top of the Justice Department. And remember, this is a Bush Justice Department where they fired people for not being sufficiently loyal, where they've weeded out people as far as even their summer internship program. So it goes to even the lowest level of people in the office they want to make sure are completely loyal and, you know, fall into line. And it's a completely politicized Justice Department. And I think it's from the top down, they really have it out for my father. It's a case of sour grapes. They're really angry and upset and bitter that they lost his case so badly in Florida, where you had a largely Republican jury completely reject their case and say that it's unfounded. And I think this is their way of really getting retribution and just trying to punish my father and torture him as much as possible.
How is your family holding up? Once again, these new charges have come across. As you said, he's been in prison for literally an additional 2 years after he was found not guilty. How is the family holding up right now?
Well, we're very distressed. We're very upset about this new trial. And we're very fearful that the contempt charges, it's the only so-called crime on the American law, I guess, in American law that has no maximum sentence. So we really have no idea what we're facing here. And I guess it's only a matter of time before we find out. But, you know, we try to stay strong throughout all of this. And my father especially helps us stay strong and have faith.
Layla, your father has been on actually three other hunger strikes from what I recall in the past, protesting his incarceration. Is there a fear now amongst your family as well as supporters of your father that he will embark on another hunger strike? I know that he's diabetic and that these did almost irreparable damage to his physical health. How are you feeling about his possibility that he might embark on another hunger strike?
I think that's something we would definitely discourage him from doing, especially because the indictment has already come. I mean, we just have to kind of fight it as much as possible. But I think as far as him embarking on another hunger strike, as you mentioned, the long-term effects are serious, and that's definitely not something we would accept.
And finally, Layla, if people want to keep updated on your father's situation and to get the latest updates, where can they go to find out more information?
They can go on www.freesammynow.com. And there's ways for them to help there. They can send letters to him, and they can also donate online as well to the Legal Defense Fund.
Our guest today has been Layla Al-Aryan, a freelance journalist who contributes frequently to The Nation magazine and is also a correspondent for Al Jazeera English and co-author with Chris Hedges of the book Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Leila Al-Aryan, as always, we will continue to follow the story, and we thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you for having me on again and for keeping the story alive.
In Berkeley, I'm Naji Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. The Israeli government continues its indiscriminate policy of deportation. On June 18th, Harmeet Souden, using his Canadian passport, was deported from Israel after being held for 4 days in Israeli detention. The reason given for his deportation was that the Shin Bet considered him a threat to the security of Israel. Souden, along with Tom Fox, Norman Kimbler, and fellow Canadian James Looney, made international headlines after they were kidnapped in November 2005. And held in captivity for 4 months while working with Christian Peacemaker Teams, or CPT. Tom Fox, the only American in the group, was executed by his kidnappers. Sadly, this deportation is just one more in a long list of activists, scholars, and at times government personnel who have been refused entry into Israel because they are deemed a threat to the state. The number of people who have been refused entry into Israel rose by 61% in 2 years, from 1,828 in 2005 to 2,941 in 2007, according to Israel's Interior Ministry's Population Administration. As more of the world begins to question Israeli actions against Palestinians, and even more brave activists, journalists, academics, and everyday citizens from all over the world begin to voice their opposition to 41 years of occupation and over 60 years of dispossession, the number of deportations is sure to rise. With us on the phone from New Zealand to speak about his recent experience is Harmeet Souden, an activist with the International Solidarity Movement, as well as Christian Peacemaker Teams. Harmeet Souden, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you. Harmeet, can you describe what happened to you when you arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport on June 14th?
Yes, sir. I arrived early in the morning. I was asked what the purpose of my visit was, and I essentially told them I was there to volunteer for ISM, as well as, you know, visit historic sites and so on. After about 7 hours of waiting and questioning, I was essentially a Ministry of Interior official, essentially said you've been denied entry, and the reason cited was that I was a threat to the security of the State of Israel. Immediately after that, I was taken to a detention facility, and I was told that I would be deported that very same day. So I was allowed one phone call, and I used that phone call to contact ISM to arrange a lawyer to fight the deportation. I decided to contest that decision to deny me entry in an Israeli court of law. My lawyer called, however, wasn't allowed to speak to him, and essentially I was taken to be deported that very night, and I felt my lawyer hadn't had the opportunity to file an injunction. It was a Saturday, and so I decided to resist the first deportation.
Why weren't you allowed to contact your lawyer? Did they give you any reason why you weren't allowed to contact them?
Their reason was that they were following protocol, and I was only allowed one phone call. And that's all they said.
And I understand, Harmeet, that you were actually verbally as well as physically abused while you were in detention. Is that not right?
What I define as assault occurred basically when I was resisting the first deportation. So I believe they used reasonable force to get me, essentially to get me from the bus to the plane. But then they applied an unjustified level of force, I think, which is what I define as assault, which is just sort of inflicting pain in order to induce fear, really, to get me to fly.
And I understand that the pilot refused to fly with you on the plane once you were on. Is that not correct?
Yes, that's right. So the cabin crew witnessed a lot of the use of force.
And what was their response while this was, while they were witnessing this? Did you get any reaction from them? Were they telling the officers to, you know, be a little bit more gentle with you or something? What was their response?
They were sort of stunned, really, and aghast. They had a word with the captain as just before they dragged me into the plane. And I was, to be honest, I was quite surprised that they used force to in the plane itself. That's I didn't realize that they could come on board in that fashion.
As I mentioned in the introduction, your kidnapping in Iraq was a pretty high-profile piece of news, especially in the Middle East. Do you feel that that might have contributed to you being denied entry into Israel?
It's difficult to say, but my assumption was that Israeli authorities knew that I'd volunteered for ISM in 2004, and they knew about Iraq. So that's why I was straightforward and honest with them initially.
Now, you said that you were coming to Palestine to work with ISM. Can you talk about what sort of work you were planning on doing while you were in the country?
Well, ISM, there's basically the Summer Against Apartheid campaign. One of the tasks at hand were recently it was reported that the IDF has been authorized to use live ammunition during any protests near the apartheid wall in the Jerusalem area unless internationals or Israelis are present. So that's something I wanted to participate in. And of course, protests against the dual road system in the West Bank. So those are the types of actions I wanted to be involved in.
And finally, Harmeet, what do you plan on doing next? Are you going to try and complain to the Canadian government about your treatment from the Israelis while you were in their custody?
Certainly, both the Canadian and New Zealand governments. I still need to discuss with ISM and my lawyer whether it's worth contesting that decision in absentia as well. And the other thing is the free Gaza movement has invited me to enter Gaza by boat in August, but I think financially I may not be able to attend, but it was nice to be invited at least.
And we are going to follow the story and also follow others who have faced deportation or are being deported at the moment. We've been speaking with Harmeet Sudan, a Canadian nonviolent activist with the International Solidarity Movement, as well as Christian peacemaker teams. In addition, he was kidnapped and held captive for 4 months while working in Iraq in 2005. Harmeet Sudan, stay safe, and thank you for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you very much.
A land without a people, for a people without a land.
The story of the past is the permanent justification for the crimes of the present. And if we will succeed in the struggle over memory, we may have a chance in the struggle over the future.
House on our land, as I peeked through the iron wires trying to understand. Yeah, Binti, my child, the land will always be here, he said, pointing to my heart and shedding a tear. Basido, grandfather, across was our orchard and my school. Why now when I look, there's a hotel and a swimming pool? Yeah, Binti, my child, this life is full of the pain of learning. You learn how dear is an olive when you see your orchard burning.
The architecture of the occupation, carving Israel then and now, based on the work of the Israeli architect and philosopher A.L. Wiseman, brought to you by CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, produced by David Parker. his 2007 publication, Hollow Land, A.L. Wiseman reconceptualizes geopolitics in the occupied territories and beyond. The political space created by Israel's colonial occupation is a web of total domination and control. On the ground, the architecture and urban planning demonstrate a late modern colonial occupation. Israel owns the subterranean aquifers beneath Gaza and the West Bank, controls the airspace above, and has weaved a web of Jewish-only settlements, highways, and security perimeters throughout the West Bank while turning Gaza into an open-air prison. The natural and built features of the landscape function as weapons and ammunition for the conflict, according to Wiseman. The occupied territories have become a series of layers and territories, each manipulated by the Israeli authorities. Borders are porous for Jews, but solid for Palestinians, while checkpoints are a source of humiliation. Said Ayash was born in Jerusalem in 1946. He lived through the Nakba, through Israel's war of aggression in 1967, and eventually moved to Canada in 1993 to give a better life to his children.
Jerusalem in 1967 was 7 kilometers square. Now it's 123 kilometers. And all of this expands for the just for Jewish people. You can't have a license to build a new home, even it's in your land. Even you can't have a deed, because in the law there you are not a citizen, you are a resident, even if you're born there. At the same time, we look, now we are the victims, but in my opinion, the real victim is all the people that are living there, if they are Jewish or Palestinian.
Can you tell me about the Nakba, if you remember that, and your experiences?
Yes, actually, I was 2 years old, but it's like, as I said, the Nakba is like the Holocaust. It will affect you. Now, Jewish young people, they didn't see the Holocaust, but it affects them, because it's what this ugly stuff happened to their parents or their grandfathers. It's Nakba for me is the same. It affect me because I feel they built this Israel on a big lie when Herzl told them, or the West and the media said, it's a land without people for a people without land. And in fact, when Nakba happened, there were 400,000 Jewish in Palestine and 700,000 Palestinian, and they ignore them, and they ignore their way of life that they live after 48. And because of that, the whole problem start. Until today, the Israelis don't want to admit that they have responsibility for what happens. And they said, it's the Arab problem, it's not our problem. So it affect me when I was young, because if we don't have this Nakba, I will have normal life like any American, like any European, but I don't.
Ismael Said is a prolific member of the Palestinian refugee community in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and chairperson of the Canadian Palestine Association. Like Mr. Ayash, he experienced Israeli occupation firsthand. When his village was destroyed in the war of 1967, he was forced to leave his home.
Well, I was born and brought up in the village of Beit Nuba. This is long before the creation of the State of Israel. We were close to the border. We were part of what became to be called the West Bank. And our village was occupied on June the 6th, 1967, as a result of the war of aggression that Israel conducted first against Egypt, and then included in Jordan and the Syrian Golan Heights were occupied, and the West Bank was occupied, and Sinai and Gaza Strip. Extraordinarily enough, the Israeli army, at the direct orders of Yitzhak Rabin, who was the chief of staff of the Israeli army at the time in 1967, he ordered the destruction of these three villages, Emwas or Emmaus, the biblical town Emmaus, Yalu and Beit Nuba, my own hometown, were systematically dynamited and bulldozed, and we were driven out, the whole villages of these three villages, approximately 14,000 people at that time, were driven out, and extraordinarily enough, at the site of these villages stands today the infamy that's called Canada Park, built by Canadian tax-deductible dollars through the Jewish National Fund, which is considered in Canada as a charitable society, which is an extraordinary act to allow a society to use our tax dollars for creating a war crime by demolishing people's homes and building recreation areas and picnic centers for others to come and enjoy themselves on the ruins of these villages.
The political power of Israel reinscribes relationships of force in the organization of the built environment. Contemporary urban warfare in the West Bank and Gaza is a constant destruction and construction of space. At the root of the warfare lies racism and colonialism. Dr. Amal Ghazal is professor of modern history in the Middle East at Dalhousie University in Halifax. She notes that the Nakba, the occupation of Palestine, and the Israeli apartheid are based on structural racism and white European colonialism.
We need to look at the whole project of Zionism and the creation of State of Israel in the context of a colonial project and of embedded in a form of racism, and that's even that exists at the level of the Israeli society itself before we even talk about the Israelis and the Palestinians. So, as I said, we should start with the late 19th century with the wave of immigrants coming from Europe and the fear they created within the Jewish communities themselves that have been there for generations. They did look at those newcomers from Poland or Russia or anywhere from Europe as a different society, very different from them in terms of the language, the tradition, the culture. And from the start, it was very obvious that there was a seed of racism within what's going to be an Israeli state, an Israeli society. It's wrong not to look at it as a colonial project, and at the same time, it's difficult not to see it as a form of European colonialism, given the perceptions that local Jews had towards those newcomers. And this exists, as we know, until nowadays. There is discrimination against some Jewish groups within the Israeli society, usually white European Jews, generally speaking, are the dominant members of the Israeli government and the Israeli society, largely speaking. And so this is one form of racism we can look at within the Israeli society itself. And as I said, from the start, it is very obvious that the seeds existed throughout.
The lines of occupation in the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem can change overnight. Borders are flexible for the daily incursions of Israeli forces who inflict torture without sullying their home soil. Palestinian homes are a potential theater of war. Their houses are to be demolished, their farms destroyed and confiscated. Eyal Wiseman, architect and author, explains how the Jewish settlements inside the West Bank are built according to a military design of concentric circles, fences, searchlights, and patrol roads. In his lecture at the Canadian Center for Architecture in 2007, he refers to them as optical matrices radiating out from a proliferation of lookout points, settlements, scattered across the landscape. John Elmer is a Canadian journalist who has covered recent events in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
Well, it's important to understand, I mean, the patterns of the Israel-Palestine conflict have been repeated throughout the last 200 years of nationalist conflict, where you have indigenous populations separated from settler populations. So in Canada and the United States, here in North America, we call them reserves or reservations, and the Afrikaners in South Africa called them Bantustans, and in Nazi-occupied Europe, they were called ghettos. Sharon and Olmert and the Likudniks prefer to call them cantons, but this sort of separation of the indigenous population from the settler population has deep roots. But what's interesting in the situation in Israel-Palestine is that the ghettoization of the Palestinians has become legitimized and is, in fact, it's considered a nationalist track. In other words, that the Palestinian state will actually be these ghettos, and so the legitimization of it is significant. And what you have in the Gaza Strip is an open-air prison that has been put under media scrutiny for the last maybe year and a half or so. But really what's been going on in Gaza is the creation of an open-air prison for the last 20 years. And immediately following the first Palestinian uprising or intifada in 1987, which is actually probably the third or fourth Palestinian uprising. Since then, the creation of the open-air ghetto in Gaza has been on the agenda. It started with checkpoints outside of the Gaza Strip, which were the first checkpoints in the West Bank and Gaza. And then it has proceeded over the years to look what people would recognize if they're familiar with seeing what's called the apartheid wall or the separation barrier in the West Bank. That barrier surrounds Gaza as well and has for a number of years. But there wasn't an anti-wall campaign when Gaza was walled off. It was actually quite quietly done, and it was done ostensibly as protection for the Israeli settler population that was living an opulent life within the Gaza Strip until 2005, when there was the quote-unquote disengagement from Gaza, which was something very different than a withdrawal. Withdrawal is a legal and military term that didn't happen in the Gaza Strip. All you had was what the Israelis call a redeployment. A redeployment of forces to the borders of the ghetto. There was no redeployment of the airspace, which is completely controlled by Israel over the Gaza Strip. And so for one sitting in the Gaza Strip, you look up at any moment and you'll see a radio-controlled drone flying over, taking pictures. Apache helicopters in the air are not uncommon. Neither are F-16 jets. If you were to look out over the sea, which you can from almost anywhere in the Gaza Strip, 7 kilometers at its widest section. If you're to look out over the sea, you see naval, sophisticated 21st century Israeli naval vessels fully loaded, patrolling the coast and often firing into the ghetto from the coast. And in practical terms, you have a situation in Gaza where people who are university age living in Gaza, you know, under the age of 25, they've never left the Gaza Strip. And I don't mean never left to go to Paris or to Toronto to shop. I mean they've never left to go to the West Bank to visit their family. They've never left to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. This is a ghetto population, an imprisoned population that's more than just a cliche to say that it's an open-air prison. People are not traveling in and out of this territory. The siege that has been inflicted on the Palestinians that's described variously by the United Nations as shocking and shameful, has led to a caloric intake drop of 50% for the people living in Gaza, 80% of who are living under $2 a day, U.S., each day. 90% of industry stopped. There's no power. There's no water. And the lack of power and the lack of oil and gas makes it so that the secondary and tertiary things that require energy are not running. The sewage doesn't run. The water wells don't run. Choices in the hospitals have to be made about whether the incubator is going to be on or the dialysis machine is going to be on. They have to decide who's going to get the gauze or not. This is a siege that's total. You know, there's no gas stations open. There's no commercial consumer gas stations open. They're all closed down. There's no cars on the road to speak of, because there's no gas. You have people doing things like pooling their gas and giving it to the Red Cross so that the Red Cross can run the ambulance service. You have people taking flour out of their homes and literally taking it down to the baker so that the baker can make bread. This is the siege inside the open-air prison, and the control is total around the border. In fact, in many cases, it was described by Jennifer Lowenstein, an astute observer in the United States who's visited Gaza regularly, that it's actually, in many cases, it's worse than a prison in Gaza, because in a prison, the walls and the gates are closed, and the sniper towers are facing out. If someone was to escape from the prison, the sniper towers would be used to cut someone down as they left the prison. In the Gaza Strip, the sniper towers are faced into the prison, and the artillery and the aircraft and the naval vessels are faced into the ghetto, and the attacks come into the prison while you're inside the prison, and there's entire buffer zones around the walls in Gaza, so people don't even approach the wall. You know, this concept of going up to the wall and spray painting Free Palestine is an absurdity in the Gaza Strip. You'll be shot dead whether you're a 12-year-old schoolgirl, as we saw in Rafah a number of times during the Intifada, or you're attempting to go and pick strawberries, even as we've seen families wiped out as they go out into their strawberry fields. Israel controls not only the prison, but they control the buffer zones around the borders of the prison.
Let's speak a little bit about the West Bank. In the philosopher Michel Foucault has talked about the panopticon, which is an idea about prisons where there's an all-seeing eye of the guard, the controlling force which sees everything.
Well, definitely. I mean, the settlements are one part of the panopticon equation, because you also have more than 500 checkpoints and obstacles. You have constant military presence daily incursions into multiple villages. An average day, when you look at United Nations records, an average day will have between 5 and 10 military incursions into one village or another in the West Bank. Definitely you have the settlement apparatus, which continues to expand. You know, 225 settlements, 125 of them official, half a million Israeli Jews living in the West Bank with super nationality, with super rights, their own highways, their own roads, their own military protection, their own water systems, as you said, controlling the highest of the hillsides, which effectively means you control the valleys, because you have a paramilitary. These settlers are paramilitary formations. They're not simply families that have moved off into the West Bank, because of a biblical calling. These, by and large, these people are either economic settlers, that is, people that have moved there for a quality of life issue, and to hire guards, hire guards is one thing, but to also have the military presence of the IDF in the West Bank. And these settlements, it's important to understand, wouldn't last. Well, neither would the Palestinian, Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority wouldn't last one day. The settlements and the collaborationist regime wouldn't last one day if it weren't for IDF incursions into the areas. So there's no doubt about it. These settlements are geopolitical. They're placed in particular areas over key aquifers, on key highways. And this is the way the State of Israel has been built since day one. And the settlers there's quite a bit of strategic clarity, if you will, from the settlers. They're very open about what they're doing. And in the 2003, when I was in the West Bank, in many cases it made sense as a journalist to travel on settler-only roads, because if you were to travel from the north in Jenin and to Jerusalem for a meeting on a day, it might take you 2 days to get from Jenin, which is about 75 kilometers from Jerusalem, or you hop on a settler road and you end up there in an hour. And so these are the kind of realities that dictate daily life in the West Bank. And so speaking with some of the settlers that I hitchhiked with on occasion and asking them these types of questions about their lifestyle, many of them were in opposition to the, apartheid wall separation barrier, the 725-kilometer wall that weaves in and out of Palestinian territory and circling Palestinian population centers and expanding the State of Israel. The settlers are in opposition to these, to the wall, because it's actually, as one settler told me, because it's like cutting through your living room. You don't put a wall through your living room. I mean, this territory is considered all theirs. The Palestinians are a temporary nuisance until they can be pushed off into their proper state, as the settlers conceive it in Jordan or in elsewhere in the Arab states. And this is the settlement project, since the beginning of the State of Israel. It's been as Jonathan Cook points out, a formation of ghettos and fortresses, Jewish fortresses protected by these sort of panopticon ideas, watchtower, you know, the watchtower and the sniper have been the part of the Zionist project in Palestine since the 19th century. And so, you know, it's, one settler told me it's like Lego bricks. You just keep building settlements and connecting them and ultimately connecting them. The project is a long-term project for these settlement projects. And the way that they look in the West Bank, you know, you have these basically prefab villa-style houses on the top of a hillside that look surreal in the way that they're unfolded. They're not, you know, we get this idea of a caravan, of a trailer up there, and some, you know, some Zionists who believe the Bible has, you know, pushed them back to the land that was always theirs, and their pioneering spirit that we've heard a lot about on the 60th anniversary of Israel is what creates these settlement projects. But one day in the West Bank, we'll show you that the settlements are massive state infrastructure projects. They're pre-bulldozed, you know, they're built all at once in massive one-fell-swoops type construction, and they're building cities. They're not really building, you know, trailer park, small hilltops. They're building major cities, and sometimes it takes a few years to unfold these cities. It takes a few years to connect to them, as they're called. Settlement blocks are basically connections of multiple settlements that at one time or another, you know, were individual and that are ultimately connected through their security roads, through their buffer zones. You know, and you see the fence in the West Bank. The fence, as I said, in Gaza is the same in the West Bank. The fence doesn't demarcate the border. It demarcates an area around which there's a buffer zone. So Palestinians are in danger not when they walk up to the wall, but when they go anywhere near what are perceived as the borders. And so the settlers enforce this with a paramilitary regime, shooting at Palestinians as they try to pick their fruit, you know, effectively separating people from their land, effectively carrying on the dispossession through paramilitary means. And the army can then sort of can disassociate itself from the settler behavior and occasionally, as we see, actually confront the settler behavior. But what's going on is a massive project with collaboration between the state and the settler movements to continually expand the state of Israel while the world is negotiating some sort of peace process. The state of Israel has been built from day one without international legitimacy by what it calls facts on the ground. And the settlements and the panopticon nature of the settlements are you know, the facts on the ground par excellence. And so it's important to understand the role that they play. These are not just, you know, these are not just back-to-the-earth pioneering people. This is a massive state project to colonize the land and ultimately, wherever possible, to displace the Palestinians.
Grandfather, why is there a new house on our land? As I peeked through the iron wires, trying to understand. Yeah, Binti, my child, the land will always be here, he said, pointing to my heart and shedding a tear. But Sido, Grandfather, across was our orchard and my school. Why now when I look, there's a hotel and a swimming pool? Yeah, Binti, my child, this life is full of the pain of learning. You learn how dear is an olive when you see your orchard burning. But Grandfather, why I can't go water the tree at Mama's and Sada's grave? Why I can't visit them and tell them I'm a good girl and behave? Yeah, Binti, Mama has died giving birth at the checkpoint, loves you with all her heart. Her blood spills into the soil, the earth of all of Palestine, she will never depart. But Sido, Sido, I said crying, when can we return back home? Yeah, Binti, he responded, it doesn't matter where we go, Palestine is ours wherever we roam. He took me by the hand, leading me away from the fence, and held me close in an embrace. And I felt his heartbeat, and I saw the tears of sadness sliding down from his face.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer Ghassan Benoura. segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Naji Ali for Crossing the Line, signing off.